Going live now. Okay, cool. We're live. Cool. Right. Let's try this again. Sorry for the technical difficulties if anyone was watching the first stream. This is episode 3 of Homie and the Dude. Today we're doing a new show called the Fight Night Recap, where we will be talking about a fight night that we recently watched. We're hoping to do this in the future after every kind of fight night that we watch. Today we're talking about UFC 250. Before we get into it, I want to just lay out two disclaimers. The first one is that if you're watching this and you're not a fan of bad language or you have any kids around, this might not be the best time to watch, because sometimes we also dip into taboo topics as well. So if you're not into taboo topics and bad language sometimes, then this might not be the one for you. As well as that, we are also talking about combat sports. If that isn't for you, if you're not down with that, then this also might not be the show for you. You can tune in next week for maybe a little bit of a different one. As well as that, just want to profess we are not MMA or combat sports professionals. We are simply here trying to talk about the fight night that we watched, share our opinions, express how we feel, and hopefully give you guys a bit of entertaining content about the fight night, UFC 250. Right, let's get into it. So, Tom, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm hoping my audio is going to hang in there for an hour or so. And if it does, amazing. And if it doesn't, I don't know what to say.
We'll see.
We'll see what happens.
In terms of, so just to kind of recap for people what we talked about just before we cut out. So we aren't MMA professionals. We don't have anything to do with that. However, we do have a little bit of background with combat sports in terms of Tom mentioned that, you know, you grew up in Vegas and your mom used to get you tickets to fight nights, and that like sparked your initial love for combat sports and stuff like that. So why don't you go talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. So just real briefly, I just have gone to fights my whole life through various like lucky situations. My mom would come home and she'd have tickets to like Sugar Ray Leonard versus Thomas Hearns or George Foreman and, you know, I don't know, Ron Lyle or Larry Holmes. And so I grew up with that and it was just amazing. And I caught the bug immediately. Muhammad Ali was my, and still is like my life hero. I just, I cried when he lost to Larry Holmes. I think it was in 1980, maybe, like literally cried. I was 14 years old. So yeah, the fights have been like deeply something that I've been passionate about. And then it sort of drifted. So it's mostly been boxing, and then it drifted to MMA and mostly UFC, I'd say, since UFC started. And I've had some dips and peaks as far as interest in UFC. But I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we've certainly, you and I, Bodhi, have had that as a real like bit of common ground for us to come together and just enjoy the fights, particularly in the UFC. And then my own personally, I did a little bit of Wing Chun Kung Fu in LA and learned that sort of very close hand-to-hand combat stuff, which was interesting. But when you reference that against like what we now know as far as how successful that would be in the octagon, it, you know, it gives you a different perspective. And then we dabbled a little bit in some jiu-jitsu about four or five years ago. Mm. So we have a little bit of a flavor. Certainly have not like competed in any level, but yeah, well, you've competed in different aspects. So over to you.
So, well, specifically when we did jiu-jitsu, it was Brazilian jiu-jitsu as well. That's important to mention. In terms of Wing Chun, I just want to make a comment on that. It's seen as, you know, it obviously Bruce Lee has big influence in that area, and you know it's also huge within the movie industry at the moment. You have the IP Man or Ip Man, I don't know how it's pronounced, movies, which are a lot of that has a lot of Wing Chun in it and stuff, in the choreography. But you've also got people like Tony Ferguson who are actually training Wing Chun and then bringing it into the octagon. So we can't say it's entirely not for the octagon, but it's definitely an interesting style to go for when you're going into the octagon, is maybe my opinion on that one, I guess I would say, with the Wing Chun. In terms of my experience with martial arts. So for me, actually, the whole love for combat sports started probably when I was about 7 or 8. Now, for some parents, you're going to totally disagree with what I'm about to say. Other parents, you might agree, but Tom and Tracy, my parents, allowed me to watch movies that were a lot, were rated a lot older in age than I was at the time. So, for example, I remember around 7 or 8, I got to watch Kill Bill, Lord of the Rings, Troy, like movies that were like big epic war movies, but also ones that had beautiful like Japanese culture in with like martial arts in it. And not only that, but then I started loving, you know, the whole Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan. You know, I watched a lot of early Jackie Chan movies as well,
Jet
just
Li.
Jet Li as well. Yeah, all over the place in terms of those. And then also then gone into the whole more Asian cinema since then, and looked at like the Jackie Chan like trio. I've forgotten the other two guys' names actually at the moment. They're eluding me. But their three movies that they make are absolutely incredible. They all trained under like the same guy, and they always make awesomely choreographed movies that have incredible stunts all the way through. Obviously, Jackie Chan being the all-round master of that in terms of doing his own stunts. But yeah, so movies is what kind of inspired my love for that. And I love like Batman, and he's all about hand-to-hand combat. He's disabling his foes with hand-to-hand combat and things like that. So then for years, I kind of just watched it in the movies. And then when we got to Spain, I think you guys soon realized, and I also kind of was openly honest to you guys, that I was being bullied here and there, and that there was moments where I wasn't essentially fitting in because I was the English kid in a Spanish town. And we also didn't live in the best neighborhood, which is just the truth. And so it wasn't like I had much option, but we as a family decided that I was going to take karate lessons because it was time for me to learn how to stand up for myself and to go, you know what, enough's enough. If you're going to pick on me, then I'm going to defend myself, you know, kind of thing. And I started karate when I was, I think, how I must have been, because I did it pretty much till we to the year before we left. So I must have been like 8, no, like 6, I think. And I started in just doing basically what, if people know Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, he does Kenpo karate. I did another branch of the type of Kenpo karate that he does called Kushiryu Kenpo karate. And I studied for 5 years. I was one belt off of a brown belt by the time I finished. And also, I had achieved the accolade of being the champion of Spain in my weight class at the time. However, I then lost,
Twice.
yeah, for 2 years. Yeah, held the belt for 2 years. And but then the weight class system got changed, and I ended up being put against dudes that were like twice my size, and just started getting kicked in the head a lot more than anyone wants to be, and realized that I wasn't meant for the cage, that I wasn't meant for the ring, that I wanted to keep my brain cells just a little bit more intact. I think getting rung, I had one specific fight where a dude like spinning heel kicked me to the side of the head, and I clearly just remember seeing stars and being like, I'd never want this to happen. Like, I can just feel like that sucked so much. Like, yeah. So that's kind of my experience. I like I said, a few years later, me and Tom did like 4 or 5 Brazilian jiu-jitsu classes, which were really fun. We absolutely loved it. And for anyone who is looking for a hard cardiovascular exercise and also strength and endurance and all of that, there's nothing better than Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like, the moment you start, as me and Tom describe it, drowning in human, you start to realize your own mental, like, strength as well as your body's physical strength very quickly. I think I threw up at least after the first 3 classes that we had. I'm not sure on your end, Tom, but I was not physically in shape for that either.
Yeah, that experience. So I'm just going to try to like share that experience, because it is a distinct experience when you are going in a grappling match with someone that is way more skilled than you are. It's ridiculously taxing to your entire system. Like, your brain is on overload, like seizing up with like panic, but trying to be tactical, and you know, but you're also like being maneuvered in certain ways that at times you think, he's making me go this way, and I want to go this way, but I have a feeling that if I go that way, I'm going to get submitted even faster. So you're just like in a world of overload, physically, mentally, emotionally. You're like in a heightened state of panic and everything. And it literally turns all the dials right up when you're a beginner at jiu-jitsu, certainly. And it's so, so challenging. And the thing about it though is, yeah, like for the first several sessions, you feel that you're just overmatched. But at some point you get like this little tiny win, right? Where you'll roll out of something the way that, you know, the teacher told you to do, or you'll do a little bit of a move and it actually works, or you get your, like when we both got our first submission, that was amazing. We both got it on the same night. Yeah. And that was it's just like, it's like these layers of learning that when they open up, you get this buzz that's pretty incredible. And that's sort of the early stages of jiu-jitsu. Then we moved away from Taunton, and Bristol has different jiu-jitsu schools. We're really interested in 10th Planet just because of that systems is just something that we're fascinated by, with what Eddie Bravo has done, expanding the jiu-jitsu tree, let's call it, of knowledge and of pathways. And there isn't one in Bristol. So we've been on the sidelines for a while. And I'm getting to the point where I'm too old. When I say that, other people will be like, no, you're not too old. But like, I don't want to put my body through what it would take to get competent at jiu-jitsu right there. I feel like my time has passed with that.
That's a fair enough statement. I would also then counter that with Jerry Coco Diaz does a doozy, and he's fat and old as hell, dude.
That's true.
He's a beast, dude, and you know he's rolling with dudes, and yeah, I mean that's what I'd say to that. But
here's the thing. Let's talk about this a little bit. The risk with jiu-jitsu is that you are at your risk level is at the mercy of how respectful your training partners are of the principles of jiu-jitsu. And so mostly, like 90%+ of the time, everyone is super respectful. And if someone is in a point where they are tapping because they're in a situation where their body is compromised, then that person will release and be caring of that. You know, they'll make sure that you're okay. I will say that there are situations that for whatever reason, people are a little bit more over, you know, exuberant about what they're doing. It could be just because they're excited about having put you in a situation, or some people are just a little bit more like, I don't know, like aggressive, and they want to really tweak it and just tweak it that little bit more. And that's where you can get, you know, that you can get your shoulder ripped or your knee ripped or your ankle ripped, that type of thing.
So just two things that I want to clear up for people who aren't big into Brazilian jiu-jitsu or martial arts or things like that. First one is when Tom's talking about like tapping and things like that within the gym, like you're not pushing submissions to a point where it's going to be hurting someone. You push to a point where they need to tap, but it's also a respect if you tap when it starts hurting as well on both sides. So, but no, just the reason that Tom brought that up is because the school we went to, we specifically were starting to get bummed out with, because thugs were just turning up and dudes would just be cranking us out. Like I definitely had a few like hard like neck injuries from rear naked chokes and like some weird stuff with my shoulder as well, that just because we were pretty much rolling with dudes that weren't, in often cases, super cool with stopping like early, and were taking it, again, not respecting the level that we were and understanding that. But there was also one or two guys that were really good with us as well while we were there, that I also have to say that were amazing.
Let me just say this real quick. If we were in their situation, we might slide into that. It's not like we would vindictively do it, but if you get to a point where like you get to the next level and then new meat comes into the gym and you can try some of your stuff out, yeah. I could see myself like potentially just slipping into like really getting a deep, like, I don't know, rear naked choke or like some sort of other, like, I don't know, arm Kimura type thing, and just like being really solid with it and not being completely conscious of the respect of the practice of the martial art. So I get it.
So the other thing I wanted to say for people who aren't super aware of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, something that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu something that Tom mentioned was the Eddie Bravo system versus like what I guess is known as like standard Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. So Eddie Bravo's system is made more for MMA and defending against I guess like punches and stuff that are coming at your way, as well as also jiu-jitsu and stuff. But further than that, his system is specifically designed for like no-gi jiu-jitsu. It's more designed so that you are dealing with people when you're like in the MMA ring. Often dudes aren't wearing a bunch of clothes. You'll notice if anyone's watching MMA, you'll notice dudes don't wear a bunch of clothes. So it's less to grab onto, where traditional Brazilian jiu-jitsu, they wear the standard, like I guess what people consider the karate uniform, where you've got the like folding white jacket with the belt and the white trousers. And it's a different system because when you've got clothes on, you can hold people's clothes and grip them in different ways and choke them with their own like collar. Like I don't know, for me, I don't like the idea of someone choking me with my own collar. That just makes like not even that I disrespect the main line of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I think it's so important to respect where it came from and the Gracies and all of that. But also, I definitely stand on the side. If someone is choking me with my own t-shirt, I am pissed off. Like that sucks. So I definitely prefer the no-gi style, where that kind of stuff isn't happening and it's more about the body manipulation than the clothing manipulation. But something interesting that I read, I'm pretty sure I read somewhere that the definition of jiu-jitsu is actually folding one's body within clothes or something like that. Like it's along the lines of like you're folding a body within clothes or something like that. I can't remember exactly. I'll have to look it up.
But the other side of it is like with Grace, like the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu system was, I'm not going to like quote anything here, but so pardon me if I'm getting it's not exactly right, but it was based around street fighting in the favelas, right? Like the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu system was you challenge someone to a fight, like you trained in your gym, but stuff got settled outside your gym. And it was like anything goes, and that's where Gracie then started proclaiming like we have the system to beat all systems, and for like all, and that's when like MMA started. It's like, oh really, you do? Well, karate's badass, or like kung fu is badass, or like judo will, and so the Gracies were just like, let's do it.
I think it's super, super interesting. Especially, I love that, the UFC and that all these MMA, I guess, promoters are doing this beautiful thing of bringing the best in the world at what they do together and challenging, the best in Muay Thai versus the best in kickboxing, the best in grappling versus the best boxer. And, it's really beautiful. And then there's times when you get things like, and just bringing it all the way back around to UFC 250, things like you get a whole rounded MMA fighter who can do everything in Amanda Nunes, for example, someone who is 100% well-rounded in ground, grappling, ground and pound, clinch, cage work, and then stand up as well. Like when you're fighting one of those, then that's the new breed of fighter that are coming up through now, that are learning all the different types at the same time when they're young, rather than being a specialist who then has to learn the other aspects of MMA. So dude, I thought, should we go into UFC 250? Should we?
Let's do it. Yeah, we've yeah.
So just being honest with everyone. So again, we're not the most avid fans. We don't know all the statistics. We're not fully invested in all the fighters within the entire UFC roster, because there's also hundreds of them. So we do typically, I guess, maybe what you call a generalized view of the MMA community. We're not super unknowledgeable, but we know a little bit more than people who don't watch it so typically. So for me, the first, what was the first fight that I was pretty not as in unimpressed, but I know that the one fight where the dude's brother died, he really put on a show. You wanted to say something about that, Tom, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm just looking up the names now because, we had a little bit of a note system that went away when the feed went away.
Got it.
So,
It was Cody Stammen versus Brian Keller.
yeah.
So Cody Stammen's brother recently died. I think it was 2 days before the fight, and he went in very emotional, but he put on an absolute show of it and just beat this dude around for the whole round. I don't know, but what you want to say something about this fight, Tom? Go for it.
So Brian, it's Brian Keller.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's a pretty like tried and true veteran, but he's had a little bit of a good run and was coming in like to advance his career for sure. This was a big opportunity for him. And you have this kid Stammen who comes in, and his 18-year-old brother dies 2 days before. His other brother, who's meant to be in his corner, goes back and is supporting the family. So Stammen is literally walking into the ring without his main corner man, and also with the knowledge that his brother just died. And for me, like a big part of MMA is like, I love the technical stuff, but I also love to get in the, like try to get into the mindset of like, what creates someone that wants to get into the ring and challenge their skills in the rawest way against someone else. And so he was so inspiring in just how focused he was on the job that needed to be done. And he was, you know, tactically, he was great. He's a little like bulldog. And I believe, I might get this wrong, but I believe he went up in weight for this. So he allowed himself to not have to cut too much weight. And he was just thick. His legs are thick. But his technical like concentration was flawless for three rounds. And then as soon as the fight ended, you could see emotionally, he just like everything released, and he finally let himself mourn the loss of his brother. And it was hugely emotional just to watch it, and hugely like inspiring to see how he was able to manage all of that. So big ups to him. I loved watching him fight on both on a sporting level, but just on a like human level.
And also condolences to the Stammen family and everything that went on with that is it's horrible. But an amazing fight. Like you said, dude, he really put on a show, and it was evident how painful that was for him. But like you said, for someone who was that like heartbroken in those moments, he held his shit together so well, and he battled like an absolute champion.
And let's give props to Brian Keller as well.
Yeah.
He was so respectful. Like even before the fight, he tweeted out like, I just need to like really, really show that this is an insane situation that I'm even having to fight this guy who his brother just died. I can't tell you how respectful I am of him. And it was just a great example of like martial arts and just respect of each other.
Yeah,
I love that fight.
I agree. For me, the next one that I wanted to talk about was actually the Chase Hooper fight, the Alex Caceres Chase Hooper. The reason I wanted to bring this up is because I think something that I think everyone knows the UFC does is like when they get a prospect that either builds some traction like pre-entering the UFC and then also builds a couple of traction in their first couple of fights in the UFC, they want to start moving them up the ranks as fast as possible, because while they're still entertaining, the faster you move them up the ranks, the more you're looking at them getting in bigger fights. And again, the crowd loves the people at the top. So by him fighting the people at the top, he gets more, so on and so forth, more crowd, more money. That's the idea. But I think the interesting part about Chase is he definitely came in as a specialist. And, you know, we saw him jump guard a bunch of times in that fight. And for me, I thought about it afterwards. I was like, that was a hard fight to watch because this kid is really young. And he's been put up against someone who is a much more of a trained fighter. He's had a lot more fights. His record might not be super amazing, but I'll tell you what, he still is a veteran within what the sport is. So for me, that was a big step for Chase Hooper to try and take. And I think he put everything he had on the line. Like I remember you and me saying, like, in terms of like who had the most heart in this, in the whole card, who put out the most heart when we were watching. You know, I think Cody Stammen is someone who could be on that list. I think Chase Hooper as well, because even though he got beaten, he was in there for three rounds and he was taking some heavy punches. Like he took some very heavy punches and some big punishment. It was one of the first fights that he's probably taken that amount of punishment from anyone. So I was impressed that he stayed in there, but also I'm like, cool. Now he knows where he stands, and now he's going to start working his way up the roster. Like the training now starts almost. Like I feel like coming into the UFC, you have to get that first loss to almost know where you stand, or else you just work your way to the top, and then you get to the top, and then you're waiting for the loss to lose your belt. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. Here's what my takeaway on the Chase Hooper situation was. First of all, I thought he was really entertaining the first time we saw him, and you know, he's like Ben Askren's little like son, and there's some buzz around just how floppy his hair is, and just, he's a kid, like he literally is a kid, and he's got a kid body, and he's in there against men, and he's, I mean, it's pretty sick that he's even doing that.
Yeah,
but I think the UFC did him an injustice. Like he should have been brought along a lot slower. Like this, like Caceres, I think has had more fights, or Caceres has been fighting in MMA. I don't know, there's some statistic that shows that his experience was like multiple times the experience that Chase Hooper had. So why would you like put one of your future like revenue streams and potentially someone that's going to really move the sport in there with someone that has a lot more experience than you. Now, maybe the UFC just overshot their estimation of Chase Hooper. Maybe they were like, he's ready for it. But dude, why rush him? Like he's 19. Like why rush him?
Funny, but yeah, I totally agree, dude. Like I think that's almost what I was trying to say, is either he was going to work his way all the way up through, or, you know, he's going to get that loss at some point. He's young and he's a specialist in something as well. Unless you're Khabib and you've got the level of training that Khabib has and had when he came into the UFC, you're not going to dominate a division. Like that's just not going to happen, you know, especially when you're 20. Don't get me wrong, you can have trained your whole life up until you're 20. But if someone's 26, 27, that's still 5 more years of experience that they have on you. And 5 years makes a huge difference. You know, that really does. So I would say, you know, I take my hat off to Chase Hooper actually for that fight. I was like, the kid went out there and threw some leather and put his heart on the line. I was like, you know, that wasn't a bad one at all. I definitely, if I was him, I would go back to the locker room and be like, that was my first defeat. Not bad. Not bad. Like, I'm proud of myself for that one. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think, I agree. Like he's like a fighter, although he has a baby face. That dude is tough. But I will say this, like if you look at Chase Hooper's skill set, and he will be able to develop and he will be able to finish out his toolbox of different disciplines. What I saw, I didn't really like his stand-up game. It was a lot slower than Caceres. Like Caceres, and I don't know if you can get skills, but as far as just like fast twitch muscles and just reflexes and just delivering punches early, a lot of that just you bring to the table. And I didn't think Chase Hooper had that. I hope he proves that wrong. But my like ceiling for Chase Hooper kind of went down a little bit. And also, you never know how people react to getting a beating like that. Like you don't forget that. Like you move on, but like somewhere inside of you, that comes with you, right? That you got roughed up pretty bad. And so I love the kid, but I think that UFC did him injustice. But I also am now wondering whether Chase Hooper was like a little bit of a, you know, the fresh young thing that they had out that maybe doesn't have all the goods that will take him super, super far into the sport.
It's funny as well, like you mentioned Ben Askren, the parallels to Ben Askren. He comes in, has two fights, and then loses. You know, like, don't get me wrong, it's not that it was a spectacular knee like the Masvidal knockout of Askren, but at the end of the day, they're very similar fighters. They're both ground game. You know, it's got something to be said for Ben Askren was considered one of the most dominant fighters, and when he was in his other promotion, he was one of the most dominant fighters ever. But then coming into the UFC, not that it's a different kettle of fish, but you have to deal with different things. You have to present differently. And there's people who are different fighters. You're not fighting the dudes that you've known for years, that you've watched tape on for years. These are new guys. This is new technique, new coaches, you know, and some of these coaches as well are some of the best in the fucking world. You know, like you are dealing with some of the best ever. Like, so I don't know. Yeah, I think it definitely, you're definitely right on that. But again, I take my hat off to the kid.
Oh, dude, I will watch Chase Hooper fight again for sure. And I want him to like have a long and successful career. But yeah,
definitely we'll log into the prelims anytime he's there to watch him. Like 100%. I was like, I have to watch the prelims to get some of that Chase Hooper. The next fight I want to talk about is actually off of the prelims and into the mainer, the main card, was the Sean O'Malley fight. Now, I'm conflicted within myself about how I feel about Sean O'Malley in terms of his personality and him as a fighter and whatnot. I get, and I'm not sure if other people around the world have been seeing this as well, but I get like what I call Conor McGregor Jr. vibes off him. Like, I really get this, especially in his post-fight interview. I was like, the confidence that this kid is brimming with is that level of confidence that almost can get out of hand a little bit too quickly. Unless you either do something like Amanda Nunes does, where I guess she's humbling herself in other ways. But I see the dark path, basically. If he had the light and the dark path set out in front of him, I see the dark path looking real appealing for him in terms of money making, in terms of getting to the championship fights that he wants, and creating hype around him and his, I guess, his product, which is himself. Do you know what I mean? Like, it, promoting himself. In terms of the fight, I took down a couple of things. So he started the fight out with a bunch of kicks. So a little bit differently to most of his fights, something that I've noticed Sean does is he finds his rhythm. And, like, you can almost see him find his rhythm. And in that first round, there's like a couple minutes where he's a little bit like they're kind of testing each other out. But then it clicked at some point and you just see him starting hitting that rhythm and finding the timing of it. So he was throwing a bunch of leg kicks and a lot of body kicks. But there was one that was amazing that hit Wineland, which was the spinning sidekick to like the liver that basically clipped him right in the liver. And you could see Wineland definitely was a little bit hurt from that, if not hurt, slowed down at least from that. And I think I've always said to you, you know, if I was in the cage, my strat would be like Gaethje, go for the legs or go for the body, because especially if you're doing a longer fight, you want to slow the guy down early on. And I think he's not making bad decisions by throwing that kind of flair in that first round and like clipping him with that kind of stuff, because it definitely is going to help him in the later rounds. Something that I did notice, and I'm not sure if other people noticed this, is he did a spinning like heel kick. He went for like a spinning heel kick to the side of the head. Missed and tripped. I thought he hurt his foot actually, because he kind of stood up and like staggered a little bit. And I haven't like looked into that of whether there's been any news about whether he hurt his foot or anything, but there was definitely like a little moment where I was like, oh, we might have had another injury. Like, because if you remember one of his last fights, he injured either his foot or his leg, and he's literally like laying on the ground having his post-fight interview with Rogan on the ground. So yeah, I was a little bit worried about that. I was worried that he'd hurt himself. But I guess from the rest of the fight and the fact that I haven't heard much from it afterwards, I assume he's fine and that it wasn't anything. But it ended with one of the most spectacular knockouts. And I'm sure we can both agree he continues to do these amazing, amazing finishes, whether it be he's got one submission and I think he's got a bunch of knockouts at this point. He fakes the right uppercut and then finishes with the overhand. And man, it was clean. It didn't look like it had power on it, but Wineland just dropped like an absolute bag of bricks. And it was really beautiful to see him walk away and just turn around and be like, cool, I'm done. I always respect it when fighters punch someone and they know he's out and they don't go in for two more, because at the end of the day, that's someone else's brain. You're rattling around in their head two more times. But also, I understand the argument that you fight till the bell, because at the end of the day, it's competition. Or fight till the ref takes you off him kind of thing. But I did respect the fact that he knew they dropped him and he was just like, done, walked away. I definitely thought that was a good move on his behalf. Whether it was for style or for the dude's health, I think it was a good move. What's your thoughts, Tom?
Yeah, so I think Sean O'Malley is probably the future. We were shocked that he's not even in the top. He wasn't even in the top 15. We looked him up afterwards and we couldn't find his name in the rankings.
Yeah.
Was it top 10 or top 15?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so he's the future. And so I put Sean O'Malley in the category of Israel Adesanya, as far as his stand-up hands, like his hands are next level. And within the MMA community, like there's, you know, there's stand-up game, but if you have skills in stand-up, like real skills, like feinting and just combinations that are just that next level, man, you're way, way ahead of most of the MMA community, because stand-up, well, I guess it's just hard to master any discipline. But if someone has a real strength, like Adesanya does, and I think Sean O'Malley does with his hands, but that combination, dude, that little feint of that uppercut was like, you just don't see that. And then for him to then continue like in a split second and turn that into a right cross that had the power to knock this dude out was next level stuff. So Sean O'Malley has that. I'm a little bit conflicted about him as well, maybe for different reasons. I guess I mostly like him a lot, and I want him to be, you know, the person that I think we're all hoping for him to be, like this, you know, this, you know, superstar in the sport. But he has popped for Peds twice, and so I mean, there is. Look, I don't really know what the percentage of guys that are Pedding right now. It's probably high, right? So you have to take this with a grain of salt. But when you're going in there and you're competing, I don't know. There's just this, and I was going to say there's this level of honor of competing my skills against your skills, but then you mix money in there and you mix, you know, all this other stuff in there. And it's just like, I just need to get ahead, and whatever advantage I can get, I can get. I get that. So O'Malley's been caught twice. It just kind of stains a little bit of my perception of him. I'm going to watch him, and I like him mostly because I think he's like super, super high skilled. Let's see him get like taken to the ground and see what he does on the ground. But my guess is he's a real special athlete that, you know, has got a big future.
He's definitely got one submission on the ground.
And yeah.
I saw his record and I'm pretty sure he's got one submission. In terms of something else that, yeah, in terms of the Pedding thing, it looks like he's made a change. Like, and not only that, but I would say his, something that I noticed in his last couple of fights since he's come back to fighting, versus in his contender fights and then his like first one in the UFC, he was a lot more showboaty in the first one. So like he was doing like a little look away, like bang and stuff. And in this fight, it felt like I was watching a seasoned veteran stand-up artist, not some kid who's trying to show off his flair and give you a bit of this and that. It felt like a dude who was really confident in what he could do and thus was calm and relax and not giving it like this, like look away over here and pop you with this one. You know, he was focused and he was in the zone and he played the game real well. I think, yeah, dude, the Pedding thing, it's like with John Jones, dude. No one can deny that he's one of the greatest ever. He's got the longest streak, I believe, defending a belt ever. He's definitely one of the greatest, but dude, his outside life affects my perception of him. And it's the same for Conor McGregor. For anyone who is a Conor McGregor fan, you know, I often question them and go, like, how do you feel about what he does outside the ring? Don't get me wrong. I also am one of those people that can differentiate. You're a person outside the ring, and then when you get in the ring, all of that disappears and it's just you fighting. So I respect him for the fighter that he is, but I definitely don't respect the outside stuff. Talking about outside stuff, actually, with Sean O'Malley, something that I wanted to bring up. And now people might take this the wrong way, but I want to just make it very clear that I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I'm not judging anyone of anything. Actually, I'm just asking a question. I'm just curious because the timing of the situation was very coincidental. So Sean O'Malley's hair, let's talk about it. Spectacular, right? Amazing rainbow. If you've seen it when it's not in the cornrows, he's got like this beautiful curly hair that's like an afro, and it's like complete rainbow. It looks like he's literally wearing a rainbow. It's absolutely amazing. The thing that I'm going to question is, he also did this a couple days into Pride Month. Now, I'm not saying that the two are connected, and I'm not even asking for him to come and tell anyone whether the two are connected. But I'm just saying the fact that he dyed his hair a rainbow, whether that be for his own personal decision, he likes the look. You know, Dennis Rodman is one of those guys who loves a sports athlete that dyes his hair crazy colors. Or whether or not it did have something to do with the fact that we just slid into Pride Month as he dyed his hair a rainbow. And as people know, the rainbow is symbol of pride and whatnot. So I don't know. I don't know whether the two are linked. I don't know if I'm reading into it too much, but it was just something a thought that came to my head that I wanted to just bring up and just talk about. I thought it was if it is a LGBT thing, I think that was really cool. And even if it isn't, I think it's a fucking sick hairdo anyway. Is basically what I'm trying to say. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I'm down with that. But I'm going to go with a different hairdo. what's the dude, now remind me, because he had like the full-on beautiful like
name. Was he, it, who did he fight?
You're gonna have to help me, bro.
It was Aljamain. It was Aljamain Sterling that had the like.
No. Yeah, Aljamain had his thing going on. No. I'm talking about the full on like, the like real like healthy Afro. Aljamain had like the high and tight. That was pretty impressive as well.
Like stacked Afro, like he had flat top with an Afro on.
Yeah, it was fucking awesome. I loved it.
I know, right? That's absolutely dope. It's amazing. That's so dope. And I loved also that his bandana fit perfectly around the like flat top bit, and then the puff was like right above his bandana. I was like, that's absolutely amazing.
That's cool.
I'll have to look it up in a minute. But yeah, so Sean O'Malley, up and coming prospect. I think we both agree, someone that we're excited to see go up through the ranks and start challenging for some belts at some point.
Even more, like if I see Sean O'Malley's on an undercard, I'm jacked. Like that does a lot for me to watch that undercard.
And now he's main card, dude. I love also as well, I really respect Dana for this, is that Sean was this up and coming prospect. Loads of people were talking about him. Pre him going down for petting, he was starting to look like a build towards like main card kind of status. And then when he came back, boom, back to the prelims. I love that they put him right back to the beginning. I think that's very fair. I think, don't get me wrong, John Jones was a champ when he got petted, and thus it makes it difficult to deal with that. But also I go, you know, I respect that the UFC brought Sean O'Malley back to the prelims. He has to work his way back up onto the main card, and he's only the first fight on the main card. It's not like he's the co-main event or anything like that, or even in the latter three, he's the first one. So I think that was a cool move by the UFC as well. I'm definitely down to see him start pushing up through those main card ranks now as well. Cool. Next fight after that was the Aljamain Sterling, Corey Sandhagen. What an absolute domination.
Yeah, and I picked Sandhagen because I think Sandhagen was on the New Zealand card. I might be wrong on that, but I've seen Sandhagen fight, and then I've read a little bit about him, and he's an absolute like well-rounded, you know, very very high level martial artist, and I had him winning somehow, and dude, he just got steamrolled. Like it may have just been a fluke position that he put himself in, but Aljamain Stewart, man, like he jumped on his back, put the hooks in, and then Sandhagen went down, and he tried one rear naked choke and he didn't get it, and then he sort of did a little bit of like pound from behind, and then he set it, and when he set it deep. And you and I argue about this,
discussion again.
Let's have this discussion. So here's my take on it.
Quickly before you go into that, just so for people who are watching who didn't watch the event, what happened was Aljamain Sterling is a very unorthodox fighter. He's very like complicated. His movement's very weird. He fights with his hands very low. And he just pressured Corey very quickly. Corey threw a body kick. He caught the body kick, rushed him to the fence. Within minutes was clenching with him, and then had his back and actually jumped on his back while standing, sunk his hook while standing. Sunk one, we're naked. They landed on the ground. Scuffle happened, like Tom said, a couple of baps to the side of the head, a little bap, bap, and then sunk it in again. And that was it. Now, yeah, go for it, Tom. Finish how it goes from there, and we'll have our decision.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was also a body triangle, like that the hooks turned into a body. Like it was like Sandhagen was in deep trouble, and that was early. So Sandhagen had to like endure 4+ minutes of that. He just couldn't. So anyway, the rear naked choke is in deep, and Sandhagen is going out, but he's going out like a champ. Like he's trying to break through it, but he's slowly losing light in his reality. And at some point he like taps, but it seems like it's either a one and a little bit more of another one, but it looks to me like a body reflex. And so my contention is that he was in and out of consciousness. And at the moment that he tapped, I think he was out of consciousness, and it was just like a muscle twitch that tapped. And then after he tapped, the referee came in and he was definitely out. Like he was out and
face down,
face down for a while. So that's my theory.
Aldro rolls him off and he's literally face down. Yeah. My thought was, I agree though that everything went as it went, except for I thought my opinion on the situation was that he was out, like going in and out of consciousness. I think in those last seconds, like, I'm not sure if Tom, I'm not sure if you've ever been legitimately choked out.
Are you going back to your like school days?
I was about to say, so a funny story that I'm happy to tell is, for people who don't know, I actually went to a boarding school, a co-ed boarding school, and I lived in the boys' boarding house with, again, a bunch of lads in the UK, and we used to often do what, in our name at the age of 15, was called dorm wars, where two dorms would go into the other person's room, tip their like wardrobes over, flip their beds, and beat the shit out of each other, and then you'd run out and leave them to deal with the mess, basically. And so at the time I was a year 11, so I was 15, 16, and we had another year 11 dorm, and we would do this shit like all the time to each other. And so one time, one of the older, he was a year older than us, but he'd been held back a year actually. A friend of mine, I won't say his name just to save him some face, but a good friend of mine who currently lives in America, got me in a rear naked choke actually, and choked me out, like clean, just choked me out. We have a rule in boarding school as well, that was tap out or pass out. You're either like, that's it. It's first one to tap out or pass out. We didn't often throw blows because if you left bruises and stuff, teachers would ask questions, so we would often grapple a little bit more. And he choked me clean out, and they just put my body in my bed and let me wake up so that my boarding house parent didn't think I was like I don't know, just see me on the floor passed out. So they put me in the bed. But I can tell you, when I was like going in and out in those last seconds, like it's definitely like a wall, like it felt like a wave, like that it was started like cool, I was cool, I was cool, and then like the blackness started coming in and the stars started going, and in those last couple of seconds though, I would imagine that he was tapping, like that was him going like, okay, here I go, Bob. And like it was like almost like he like let the arm fall and was like and kind of like, let it like bounce, and the bounce was actually the second tap. He was just like he was out, but he was out cold. It was a stellar performance from Sterling, not to mention the fact that currently in the division that they're fighting in, I believe it's the bantamweight division. I might be wrong and it might be flyweight, but I think it's the bantamweight division. Henry Cejudo just vacated his title. So currently you've got the top four guys are basically battling out for title, because I know you've got Peter Yan versus Jose Aldo, which is a bit bullshit because Aldo is way further down the rankings. But you've then also got Marlon Moraes, and then Cody Garbrandt, Corey Sandhagen, and Aljamain Sterling. So all those guys are currently fighting. Obviously, Cody Garbrandt also fought in this card with Rafael Asahuno, who was also one of those guys in those top rankings. So currently we're seeing the decision of who's going to be fighting for this title pretty soon. And I like Aljo. I'm if I were to put money places, Cody Garbrandt's got some good stuff, but man, I do love a weird, funky fighter. There's something interesting about the Dominic Cruzes, as much as I'm not a fan anymore, TJ Dillashaw's, of like the weird, funky movement. I am a big fan of that for some
reason. Isn't his nickname the Funk Master, or like Funkalicious?
Yeah, something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's definitely a problem. Like, he's a problem.
Dude, I so hope that the fighters get to choose their nicknames, and that Dana is a name and dude's the Funk Master. Just be
careful. Dude, he is like, I don't know, like who, like I've only seen Peter Yan fight once and it was hugely impressive. So people are saying he's the one.
Yeah.
But Aljamain has some skills.
Who did he beat? Who did we see him beat?
He beat Uriah Faber.
That's it, Uriah Faber.
Yeah.
Put Uriah Faber away.
Yeah. So Aljamain, man, I will definitely watch him again. He put on a show. And Corey Sandhagen, like, I don't know, like that must have hurt bad, because that was his moment to like get up into the very, very elite thin air of that division, and he got squashed. That's a bummer.
I'm pretty sure he was fourth seed as well, like fourth ranked. I think Sterling is two actually.
That's right, yeah.
So yeah, man, if you're number four and you're looking to get that championship title, he needed this win. Like, chances are he's gonna either go down in the rankings or be fighting one of the people who's almost like a semi-final fight in terms of finding out who's second or third in this title race that is currently happening. Do you know what I mean? For number
four,
almost
like a loser's bracket fight.
Yeah, exactly. They're competing for number one contender at the end of it.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's the Stern fight. It ended in, just so people know, round one. It ended with 1 minute and 28 seconds left by rear naked choke. Absolutely beautifully done. Great defensive, great offensive grappling and jujitsu from Aljamain. Awesome. Going on to the next fight, Cody Garbrandt, Rafael Asahuno. I have mixed feelings about this. Cody Garbrandt is someone who I wasn't a fan of for a while. I didn't like his bad boy persona. It seems like he may have altered that, especially getting his new coaching in, because I'm pretty sure he's now got Coach Mark Henry in his corner, as well as I believe he's still part of Team Alpha Male, but he's just added Mark Henry to his corner. So, dude, Mark Henry's legendary. He's known for what he does, and it seems like he's taken a bit of that, I want to say, almost like nervous aggression out of Garbrandt, because when Garbrandt gets like clipped once or twice, he gets angry and used to just throw those wild haymakers and just try and like knock you out. He was composed. He looked like a professional fighter today. Like, I was blown away by, on Saturday, I was blown away by the level of composure and relaxation that was going on with him in the ring. It seemed like a different being. It seemed like a different Cody Garbrandt. Now, whether a couple of wins will change, bring his personality back to the bad boy, who knows? Whether or not he's actually learned a lot with being with Mark Henry and he's really changed as a fighter, who knows? But I'll tell you what, that fight definitely made him look good. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, that last bit that you said reminds me of, we're going to talk about Amanda Nunes in a minute, but Amanda Nunes, she lost to Kat Zingano. She's beaten Kat Zingano up, but ran out of gas. So like in the third round, she ran out of gas and Kat Zingano basically like took her heart away because Amanda Nunes did not have any cardio. And since then, she has shown that she has learned, right? And she is able to go five rounds with anybody. So the question with Cody Garbrandt is, is he capable of learning? Or is he, you know, are the spots of the leopard like really, really deeply ingrained? The thing about Cody Garbrandt that like is indisputable is dude has hands. Like, he dropped TJ. I mean, don't forget, he dropped TJ Dillashaw. He's dropped like Dominic Cruz, that fight against Dominic Cruz. He out Dominic Cruz. Dude, he's got skills. The problem with him is that, yeah, he'll start getting into like a bar fight with someone. And when he goes bar fight, he gets a little roundy and then someone just beats him to the punch. And he doesn't have a great jaw. He just doesn't have a great jaw. Yeah. So he potentially could be, you know, a very, very, you know, tough competitor at the very, very top of that weight class. If he learns from Mark Henry, let's just see what happens. If he gets dinged, what's going to happen? Like, is he going to be composed or is he going to throw?
I think a good comparison to this is someone like Justin Gaethje, who came in an absolute animal, dominating. And then he, in two fights, both fights, he gets too aggressive. He sees blood and he goes for the knockout and gets clipped while almost overcompensating. Obviously, in the Ferguson fight, you see him being 1,000 times more composed. You even hear his coach telling him to pull his punches by 10% so he's not like wasting his energy. And it's whether or not, again, you know, Gaethje can continue holding that consistency up. It's whether Cody Garbrandt can now be that consistent fighter that we saw. Now, in terms of that knockout, like,
oh, dude,
wow, that was spectacular. I mean, don't get me wrong. I he fakes like this, but the fake was a little bit dubious to me. I understand the fake that he did and it worked and it was beautiful, but also he put his head down with no hands near his face. I'm like, if someone had been just a little bit more like smart about it and swung a leg up, like Cerrone with a quick switch left kick, dude, would have caught him on the side of the head quickly with that. But that being said, what's his name? Asuno bit the fake real hard, and then Garbrandt just smacked. And dude, like, that punch was what I consider almost like a movie punch. Like, that was almost like a punch. He snapped his head so hard that you're like, oh, that was Hollywood. Like, that wasn't even real. Like, he didn't even hit him. That was exaggerated. You know what I mean? But man, he clipped his head and it was on the buzzer. If people love basketball buzzer beaters, I love UFC buzzer beaters. We're talking Yair Rodriguez versus the Korean Zombie when he throws the like back elbow. And this, that's what I love. I want to see the last second. That is crazy. That is absolutely crazy.
Yeah, dude, that... So, and the other thing is, like, you mentioned it on the night that that was the punch equivalent of Jorge Masvidal's knee to Ben Askren, because it had some, like, some serious, like, smoke and mirrors to it, right? Some, like, I'm not doing anything, and now your lights are out for both of those dudes. And, like, to me, Rafael, like, and Ben Askren, oh, dude, that's a tough one to take. Like, you know why also? Because forever you were going to be on the highlight reel of the UFC. Like, how many times have we seen Jorge Masvidal's knee at Askren? Like, literally 1,000.
Yeah.
Like, and that Cody Garbrandt punch was like that. And you could see it with Rafael. Like, he got knocked out. He got back on his stool. He almost fell off of a stool. If he would have fallen off of a stool again, like, the dude, he was like
so much power in the punch that he, like, yeah. After he's awakened up, for people who don't know, if you want to go watch the clip, he literally cannot sit on the stool the medics are putting underneath him. Like, he is that gone. That punch came with Thor's blessing and Raven above it, dude. Like, he literally, oh man, it was, yeah, it was a beautiful punch. I'm not the biggest fan of Cody Garbrandt, but man, that fight definitely made me reconsider my opinions on him as a fighter and his abilities within the octagon, for sure.
Before you move on, let me just touch about one more thing. You connected Cody Garbrandt to Justin Gaethje, and Rogan talked about it. Maybe with DC, I'm not. But now it's like being theorized now that one of the more lethal weapons to have in the ring is a calf kick, and it's like so like contrarian to think it's a calf kick. Like, how? But dude, if you get hit in the calf, like, say, I mean, Justin Gaethje's quote is, if I hit someone 4 times in the calf, they're compromised. Like, they're not the same fighter. And that includes Khabib. If I get in the ring with Khabib and he gets hit, then let's see what he can do. The calf kick, dude, like, and it's cool. Like, MMA, the whole skill set thing is fascinating, because at some point it's, well, you look at jiu-jitsu, it's like, you know, standard chokes, and then it goes to like rubber guard stuff, and now it's like a lot of leg lock stuff, and it's just like this evolving, beautiful, like fluid, like evolution of an art. And right now it's the flipping calf kick that's most lethal in the ring, which is crazy.
It's crazier as well that people are going, oh wow, Justin Gaethje's got a good calf kick. And you're like, dude, this started, I believe, like the first, there was that fight where it was a kickboxer versus a Muay Thai fighter, and there, it happened in America. I cannot remember for the life of me.
Oh, dude.
And literally, the Muay Thai dude just chops his legs for the whole fight. He literally is barely doing anything else. And they actually appealed the fight, and he lost. The Muay Thai guy lost because leg kicks were technically not legal at the time. But it showed the power. And dude, that happened in, I think, the like
70s, dude.
I thought it was the 90s. I thought it was like late 90s. Was it earlier?
Is this like world, like, I forget what his name is, like his name's like super something or other, but he was like the best kickboxer. And it's embarrassing that we don't know his name, but yeah, he was like he just went in. And do you remember, dude, how that went? Like, he literally was like running. One leg was incapacitated, and then the other one started getting chopped, and he literally like could not walk.
Yeah,
it was crazy.
And dude, like, honestly, that's the thing to me is like, yeah, it's crazy that people aren't taking advantage of it. But also, dude, I understand. Something else I will say just outright is you have to be a tough mudder trucker to throw a leg kick and get checked. if you get checked throwing a leg kick, dude, that is shin to shin contact. No one, like, I don't care who you are on this planet, no one wants some shin to shin contact. Like, that hurts. Unless you are someone who has trained your, like, legs, and I guarantee most of these MMA fighters' calves aren't feeling much of it. But if you watch Cerrone and people like that check leg kicks, people start bleeding off of leg kick checks. Like, I understand why people don't throw them, but also if you can get that timing right and you can throw a nasty leg kick, yeah, dude, it's the same as what I said earlier in this podcast. Of, for me, my strategy would be attack the legs or the body in the first round, because the moment you start inhibiting their movement because their legs can't move as well, or you start chopping away at the body and their like lungs and their breathing and all that, like you start just slowing them down and taking some of that endurance away from them. I agree. Like, if I don't understand why that, I mean, obviously you got to play for each fighter, but that's an obvious strat of just slow them down in the first couple rounds, especially if you're doing like 5-round fights, like slow them down and chop at them. And I think that's one of the things I loved watching about Gaethje, was watching him swing leg kicks that literally look like they could snap a log in half. Like, it was crazy.
Dude, it works against any style as well. If you're swinging leg kicks against stand-up, they're going to have to go to their other side, right? They're going to have to go, if they're conventional, they have to go southpaw. They have to switch around just to protect that leg. If it's someone that likes to get on the ground, how much is their shooting compromised? Like, it works for everything. And so, you take away someone's leg, that's a big thing. That's a big part of your weapon. You know, it's so, I can see how it's makes sense. But it's kind of weird, right? Flipping calf kick is now lethal.
Yeah, it's definitely a scary one. I you see people's thighs and calves when they get kicked, and I'm like, I don't want that. I'll tell you right now, like, again, another reason why I stopped doing martial arts, because, dude, yo, I don't want that neither. I don't need none of that in my life. So. I mean, obviously, we got to talk about the main event. We got to talk about Amanda Nunes, the lioness, the goat of, in my opinion, and I will outright say this, I think she deserves to be ranked better than Jon Jones at this point. Like, she is the goat of goats of goats. Like, she cleared out two divisions. I mean, here's the thing. Like, I see Amanda Nunes as possibly one of the greatest female role models on this planet at this point, in terms of being a mixed race woman who is also Brazilian, coming into an American sport, dominating, being the two division champ, only person to defend in two divisions, clearing out divisions. Not only that, but beating fighters like Chris Cyborg that are unheard of, as well as also being one of the only out lesbian MMA fighters and dating another MMA fighter and being extremely open about that within her social media and community. Dude, there's no one on this planet that is a better role model other than possibly the Prime Minister of New Zealand right now. Like, literally, it's unbelievable how incredible and amazing she is as a human being outside of the ring and inside of the ring. I cannot sing her praises enough. What were your thoughts on the fight? What did you come away from that one thinking?
We talked about this a little bit during the fight, how Nunes, so there's the Bruce Lee special is coming up, and you know, the be like water quote. I felt like Nunes during that fight was like water, right? So the two first takedowns that Nunes has are off of Spencer's first. So Spencer shoots twice, gets Nunes, and Nunes reverses those and takes her down, and then proceeds to like keep her down and pound her for a while down there. And so if Spencer wants to throw, okay, well, let's throw, and I'll throw uppercuts and I'll throw big right bombs, and we'll do that as well. So she's just willing. Like, I almost think that she is now challenging herself in ways to say, like, she knocked Holly Holm out with a head kick. Holly Holm is known for her head kick game. She knocked out Ronda Rousey. It's almost like Nunes is like looking at the opposition and saying, oh, okay, Spencer's really good on the ground. I hear that she's going to like rough me up. Let's see what happens. And what happened was Nunes dominated her on the ground. Like, at no time while I was watching it, I was a little bit concerned that Spencer was slowly like bringing up her guard to the point where she might be able to jack an arm or bring a leg triangle up or something like that a little bit, but it never got close enough where you're like, oh shit, this might happen, right? Nunes was completely in control on the ground, on her feet. Spencer went like, was it three rounds? Or I think three rounds with Cyborg, or maybe five rounds with Cyborg, and was in the fight. She was never in this fight. Dude, Nunes is like, man, like, you know, one of my favorite fights of all time is Nunes versus Cyborg. That is like right up there as irrespective of boxing, MMA, anything. That was just a beautiful, like,
moment in history.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love her. Yeah. She's awesome.
So a couple things I want to say about the fight. So your whole Be Like Water thing is so true. And I also love Hicks and Gracie talks about how a lot of his Brazilian jiu-jitsu strategy is he wants to be neutral. He's not attacking. He's not defending. He's simply waiting for you to do something and he'll react appropriately. Like, don't get me wrong. I that works to a certain extent. Because obviously, in some cases in UFC, you know, they say be first, be the first one to tag him first, you know, that kind of stuff. So on and so forth. Sometimes you need to be aggressive and move forward. But it felt like Amanda Nunes was in that exact Be Like Water. Like, she was reacting to everything perfectly. Like you said, for me, those two judo throws she did were just a perfect example of her being like, cool, you want to take me down? Good luck. And she sprawled a couple of times. She had some beautiful sprawls when Felicia was shooting in as well. And every part of that game was dominated by Amanda Nunes. Now, two things that I want to talk about on the other side of the on the other side of the ring. So there's no doubt in my mind that Amanda Nunes is the greatest woman fighter of all time, and she probably will continue to dominate two divisions for like ever, unless Valentina Shevchenko somehow steps up to compete with that. Like, she's the only person at this point that might be able to. But again, she's still got two losses to Nunes at this point. So unless they do a third and she wins the third, I don't know. But
or we get Wei Ling to, like, I don't know, somehow like grow. Yeah.
Ridiculous. Wei Ling. That would be nuts. But no, I think on the other side of the ring, there has to be something said for Felicia Spencer's heart. She went five rounds with the greatest fighter of all time, stuck in there more than Chris Cyborg, who was said to be unbeatable. She literally, and the funny thing was, she didn't stop like moving forward almost. Like, don't get me wrong, the whole fight she wasn't moving forward, but I felt like she was still like throwing, no matter how slow it was or how tired she was attempting things. She was not resigned herself to being down and out. Now, coming off of that comment, I then also go, however, at the end of round four, I think the commentators were saying it, you and me were both saying it, you need to pull your fighter. Like, we were both going, she is getting beat up so much, like so much, and she was bruised and she had the hematoma on her forehead, and it was just going out of control a little bit. And for me, I think if I was her coach, I understand that a lot of the fighters say to their coach, if you throw in the towel, you're fired. But also, there needs to be a relationship between a coach and a fighter that they understand that a coach, if he sees you getting pieced up, it was same with the Ferguson fight. He stayed in it for as long as he could. But at some point, you got to recognize when your fighter's had enough. He doesn't need any more punishment. She doesn't need any more punishment. Like, we know she's not going to win this fight at this point. So let's save her for the next fight when she can possibly win, you know? That being said though, dude, she battled like a motherfucker and I respect the hell out of it. Like, that was badass. That was some top tier shit, and I hope she stays around in the UFC. I hope she I hope someone else comes to that division so she has someone to fight before she maybe goes back to Nunes or so on and so forth. But yeah, man, I think Felicia Spencer really deserves a round of applause and almost salute of respect from the MMA community for what she endured in that ring on Saturday.
Yeah, so I think, so again, like, one of my jams while I watch MMA is to try to put myself in a mindset of someone that's, you know, in that sport, in that ring, and, you know, there's just nowhere to go. And in certain situations, like, you're watching primal human shit, right? So Felicia Spencer is, at some point, I don't know how conscious she was of it, but at some point you had to think that she was thinking to herself, I don't have the skill set to beat this woman, right? She beats me with hands. She beats me on the ground. But in spite of that, dude, she did not take a step back. Like, she kept coming forward. Like, think about you putting yourself in a situation where you're in a fight with someone and you're looking across at them and you're like, they're faster, they're stronger, they're more skilled, and I'm still going to go in there and like try, and not just try once, but try and try and try and try. Dude, that's what she did. And like, you, like, taking your hat off to her is like the understatement. She was a fucking beast, and I so respect her, man, woman, like anything. Like, she like what she did is like speaks for itself as
heart, pure heart.
Yeah. So then the other thing is, to your point, if I'm in the corner, I'm doing risk assessment the whole time, right? And like with Ferguson, I'm thinking, all right, can he win this fight? Like, and your answer is, if this ever got to the ground, he might be able to pull a Doris or pull something on Gaethje. He hasn't been able to get him on the ground, so maybe there's some way. I can see you saying that. But dude, when you're Felicia Spencer's corner and you're doing risk assessment and you're going through like the list of things that she could do to win the fight, there's nothing on there. Like, she can't knock her out. She doesn't have a good enough like hand game, right? Her striking's not good enough. Nunes proved that she's not going to submit her on the ground. She's getting more and more tired. She's getting more and more damaged. Like, at what point are you thinking, we still have a chance? That's the bit that I was like uncomfortable with. Like, at some point that corner should have been like, dude, we really don't even have a chance. Like, why are we even doing this? Let's save her right now.
That's what I mean, dude. Like, pull your fighter and give them an opportunity to go back, learn some stuff, and not come away with two more rounds of, like, because again, also that debate of whether she should have been pulled out, I'm not sure if you remember, the commentators started it, and you and me started that as well, pretty much at the end of the third. Yeah. We were like, oof, that's three rounds that she has not won at all. Like, it wasn't even close. And we're like, do you pull her? And we're like, and I think, again, we kind of agreed with the commentators that it was, let's give her one more round. Let's see what happens. But at that point, dude, you're not sending her for a fifth. Like, no criticizing to the coaches. We're not professional MMA coaches. We don't know the relationship she has with her coach. We don't know how they interact. And again, what she said, if she said, if you throw in the towel, I'm going to fire you, you know, then he's probably not going to throw in the towel. Do you know what I mean? So
she may have said something else. She may have said, the highlight of my career will be going five rounds with Amanda Nunes. Like, and that might be true, right? So we don't know, like, the conversations, right? And so, yeah, you have to contextualize it. But just on, like, a feeling of humanity of just, like, let's just save her right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they had their own. I'm not at all in a position to criticize what I don't know happened as far as their conversations. But all I can do is comment on, it was tough to watch her take that beating for the last round. Like in my view, I'm not sure why that happened.
And I think we both also agreed at the end of the fight that we felt like Amanda Nunes, especially when she got her to the ground, wasn't ground and pounding her. She was just holding her there. And we felt that there was one flurry that you and me were like, she's just going to try and put her out and just end this because this is awful. But I think we both agreed that Nunes almost pulled back a little bit and was restraining herself in that last round to not inflict maximum damage. Because if she wanted to, when they were on the ground, she could have really opened her up, I reckon. And we don't know what Nunes was doing. She might have been a little bit more tired. Who knows? But yeah, she also looked like she could have gone 10 more rounds, honestly, like at the end of that. Something I wanted to bring up was a comment that Nunes made that I've heard her say similar things in the past, but at least on her social media, it's been like her being like, I am the lioness. Like, this is my jungle. Like, I am the goat. Like, she not self-professed as much, but she posts like things that other, she shares that things that other people are posting about her. So it was interesting to me to hear her go. I'm not sure if it was for the first time, but I definitely the first time I noticed it. Her go, we are the best. When she was being interviewed at the end with her coaches, she was like, we are the best team on this planet. It's me, it's my girlfriend, it's my head coach, and it's the other coach, and we are the best team on the planet. And not only that, but she also posted on her Instagram pretty much the exact same thing, which is the greatest team that has ever been in this sport. And I think something else that
What I kind of wanted to segue into with that is people don't give the coaching staff and the other people involved in these moments in UFC fighters' lives and stuff the credit that comes with that. You know, we're often quick to judge, like, why didn't you take Felicia Spencer out? Edmund Tarverdian, or the guy who was Rousey, why are you just shouting, take her down, when she's clearly rocked? Give her some, like, good info. You know, we're quick to judge, but it's very rare that people compliment and really respect those. And it's a full team. Like, MMA is, at the end of the day, actually a team sport. They have a whole camp where they train with a team of people to get them ready to do one thing. Now, I understand it's one person in the ring and whatnot, but they're still shouting the advice from the sideline. You know, it is a team sport. So I love that Nunez has started this whole "we are the best team on the planet" vibe, rather than being the lioness Amanda Nunez, which she still is. Like, fucking, she still is the goat and the lioness, but she's the prey and the predator. But I love that she's now going, we are the best, that this team is unstoppable. It's not just me, it's my coaching, it's my girlfriend who's here supporting me, my wife, actually, I think they're married now at this point, it's my wife supporting me. I love that. Like, in terms of MMA respect, you know, you and me talk about having respect and being humble within the MMA community. I love that, really love that.
Well, I would say is, I totally agree with all of that. And it just also shows, like, the evolution of the sport has not just been in the octagon with the fighters. It's been like, I've been so impressed with the corner conversations in between rounds. Dude, those guys are so calm. Like, most of the time, they are so on point with one or two specific tactics, super calm. And giving the fighters exactly what they need to, like, recover their cardio, but also come away with one or two things that they need to do with the next round. And you see it, and it's awesome. Like, that, because you're essentially watching the person that you've been committed to for probably years in a, you know, to some degree, a life or death thing. Like, someone wants to, like, take their head off, right? They come back to you, and to be that controlled emotionally is awesome.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say about Nunez is, dude, why can't we get Cyborg to just come back and let's do this again? Like, I want to see that fight again. Like, this is the thing about, like, mixed martial arts. Can we just have super fights, organization? Yeah, promotions, super fights, that, and everybody wins. Like, both promotions win. I get that if one promotion's fighter loses, but dude. That's part of martial arts, right? Let's see who the very best is.
Then there's a rematch fight, and you make like, to me, for example, I'm not sure if you've heard of, like, Michael Venom Page and, like, Douglas Lima. Not Douglas Lima. Is it Douglas Lima?
I thought it was two. Yeah.
Yeah, Diego Lima is his brother. It's Douglas Lima. He's the champion.
Bellator.
It's either Bellator or ONE FC, one of the two.
Yeah,
dude, I want to see, like, I completely agree with you. Let's get the best of the, like, I've said for years, like, make a UFC card, or, like, a Bellator / UFC card that is just champs. It's the bantamweight champs, the featherweight champs, the lightweight champs, the middleweight champs, the welterweight champs, the light heavyweights, and you just have a full card. Even the prelims are just championship fights. And just have it all as championship fights. That would be the biggest card and the biggest event in all of history ever. Don't get me wrong. It's never going to happen because of money and people being selfish and contracts and blah, blah, blah. But in a real world, Fight Island, inter-competition, like, bonanza would be awesome. That would be sick. I completely agree.
Well, here's a question. If you were, let's say you were Israel Adesanya, right? And you had gone, let's say you go through Paulo Costa and you go through Cannonier and you go through Till, and now there's no one really in the UFC, but there's this dude over there.
Mm.
At some point, for your own legacy, do you go to Dana White and say, dude, we just need to make this happen. Like, I need to prove to myself and to my people that I am the very best. Can we make this happen? Yeah. And the answer is probably no, you can't. which sucks, right? So that's where money just, yeah, screws it up. Yeah. But yeah, anyway.
I agree. I think, yeah, I think the inter-promotional thing would be very interesting. But also, I mean, I think there's a reason also why the UFC is the most well-known. Don't get me wrong, it was pretty much the, not the big first one, but almost like the big one that made it like a big popular event. Pride was huge, obviously. Pride in Japan was absolutely massive and things like that. But
F1.
Yeah, like it was, yeah, it's just, there's a reason why people go to the UFC. Now, don't get me wrong, if I was Douglas Lima, I would be going, should I be stepping to the UFC? Now, don't get me wrong, Bellator might be paying him really fucking well. Like, there's a chance that, because I know that they do a $1 million Grand Prix as well, Bellator and things like that. I'm pretty sure they do like really big cash prizes for like almost, but they do like round robin tournaments or like where you like work your way up through like a table almost, and then the two winners fight each other and big money at the end of that, basically.
Yeah.
So they do it a bit of a different system, I think. Honestly, I'm not even versed. I've seen like, I watch the highlights of stuff when they come up on my Instagram and stuff of Bellator and like ONE FC.
Yeah. But I think your point is good. Like, at the end of the day, these guys have to be thinking about finances, right? No matter how much they like fighting and how much they look at this as a competitive challenge to themselves. Dude, every time, and it's been said over and over again in different ways by different people, every time you step into that ring in a mixed martial arts fight, you come away a slightly lesser bit of yourself. You leave something in the ring. Sometimes it's cognitive. Sometimes it's stuff that you're going to feel when you're 50 years old and you try to get out of bed and you just can't use that thing as well as you used to. These guys need to get paid, man. And that's what's happening right now with like, everybody's revolting, like Masvidal, Jones, Cejudo. They're all coming up and saying, dude,
yeah,
we need to get paid. Like, come on, man. Like, you guys, like, it's like the UFC is doing this. They're like holding all the money, right? They've got all the money, bundles of like $100 bills. And anything that Dana White can't hold that falls down, they're like, that's for you. It's not cool, man. You know?
I would agree, but also like, I agree definitely in the sense of that they're definitely not paying the fighters enough. But I also see, especially at the moment, so the one thing that I do definitely give Dana a pass on, and if you watch like his press conferences, he's just constantly dealing with this question that we're talking about right now. And his response is, if fighters don't want to fight, they don't have to. Like, I'm offering you the fights, you can take the money or you don't have to, basically. And I get his point. And he's also going, I need to save my business right now. Like, a big thing that he keeps going is, he's like, I've stopped my boxing promotion. Like, he's like, the Fight Island, we haven't bought an island. We're considering like renting an island and like, or like having a space on an island to do our events, basically, is something along those lines. But at the moment, I think people, honestly, and the fighters are misunderstanding how much of a bad place I think the UFC currently is in during COVID times. Because I said to Nikki was like, they must have made so much money off of the pay-per-views. I'm like, they do, but usually they make that, like, not all that money on pay-per-views, but let's say 2/3 of that money on pay-per-views. You had the extra third of people that usually go to the events online this time. But they're all paying $70 for a pay-per-view or whatever it is for the pay-per-view, right? You then look at that in comparison. If you take that extra third of people and you give them door sales, like door ticket sales, they're paying so much more. For front row seats, you're paying thousands. It's not even hundreds at this point. It's thousands for front row seats, you know? So at the end of the day, I think Dana and the UFC have lost a lot of money based off of the fact that they don't have on-door sales. They don't have merch being sold at the events, you know, and things like that. So I think, honestly, the UFC is probably struggling a lot more than people realize. So for me, I'm kind of like, cool, I give you a pass during COVID times, but when that's done, you need to start paying your fucking fighters, because this has been a consistent problem. And now that you've taken away, and this happened years ago, now that you've taken away sponsorship on their shorts and shit, because you've got the fucking Reebok deal, it means that they're absolutely screwed in terms of making money in their own ways. They can do in other ways. Like, for example, I know like the whole CBD recovery oil and rub and stuff like that is a big one that fighters are promoting through their own Instagrams and things like that. But at the end of the day, you've inhibited their promotional ability with things like the Reebok deal and stuff like that. So it means they can't make the money. Like, either give them that, let them make their own money, or pay them more. Yeah, like there's really two options there, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's driven by greed. I honestly do, because if you, Masvidal said something like this. I just watched a clip of it before we came online, and basically, like, there's what's called a collective bargaining agreement in the NBA, and there's a players union and everything, and basically the players negotiate. I think the players get 49.5% of all the revenue in the NBA, 49%, like almost half, right? Masvidal was like, look, the last fight that, or I don't know if it's the last fight or this next fight that I'm being offered, the numbers show that I'm getting 18% of all the revenue, right? Yeah. So what's happening? Basically, we've now lost Jones versus Ngannou, and it looks like Masvidal versus Usman is gone as well. Usman's going to fight Leon Edwards or someone like that.
Or even Masvidal McGregor, especially now as McGregor's dropped as well.
Yeah. So, like, the fans are losing really, really good fights because of finances, right? Because of the UFC wanting, like, so much profit. And they're used to so much profit. But the other problem is there's nothing to push the UFC to change, because in the NBA, if they don't get what they think is fair, they'll strike. There's been strike season. Same with the NFL, same with baseball. So there's like a collective strength in numbers that the MMA community never can get together, which is, let's get a union together. Let's have a representative. Let's have Dominic Cruz be our representative that goes and talks to the UFC, and he's going to represent 50 fighters. And this is what we want.
Bloody Chael Sonnen.
Yeah, Chael Sonnen. Yeah, like, that's what they need. And but, you know, the UFC is, like, playing such hardball that it's kind of sucks, because they know, dude, like, the dirty little secret is, as a promoter, you don't really care who the champ, you're going to be around in 20 years. And yeah, you know those fighters that are around now are going to be damaged in 5 years. And those fighters that are going to come along in 5 years are going to be damaged in 10 years. And, like, this whole, like, cycle, this like, conveyor belt of humans that are coming through are to feed your pockets, but there's not this, like, and I get it, dude, it's like, it's capitalism, and it's like, let's just maximize profits and all this other bullshit. But at some point, is there any level of, like, what's the right thing to do here? Like what is, like, should we have maybe a retirement fund for fighters? How cool would that be, right? So a fighter fights till they can barely talk anymore. At least they have a retirement that they don't have to, like, go around shuffling in, like, a gym, barely being able to put sentences together and making, you know, whatever, like, $1,000 a month to be the spokesman in a gym because they don't have any money to pay their rent. Like, there's got to be some middle ground. Like, the UFC's got to loosen up just a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree. But also, there's the other side of the benefits to not having unions and stuff like that, which is, don't get me wrong, I think it's something that should be looked into, but it means that contracts are more flexible. I know Dana, when someone says they want to retire, he completely releases them on contract, regardless of how much time, how many fights they have left on them. I know things like, you know, again, there's things that mean that fighters can be paid more, in some cases, because of the loosey-goosiness of it, you know, and also being able to take fights on short notice and stuff like that is a bit more allowed through that kind of stuff. But also, yeah, I agree, dude, something needs to change. Something needs to shift. The power needs to be in the hands of, don't get me wrong, you can't have John Jones demanding Deontay Wilder money, as Dana White put it, which is $30 million. You cannot have him demanding that amount of money. That's way too much money. But I definitely think the greatest of all time deserves a decent portion of money. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I was actually surprised he makes five. He announced that he makes five plus a fight, which I think that's awesome. Like, I didn't realize that he makes that, because the declared purse is usually like $500,000, $700,000. Like, if it's Conor McGregor, it's $1 million.
Yeah.
DC versus Jones, I think they both made $1 million, maybe. I don't know. But so, some, like, behind the scenes, Jones is making $5 million at the end of the day, whether it's pay-per-view money and guaranteed money or whatever. That's still, that's a good paycheck. But when you compare it to Deontay Wilder,
yeah,
he's underpaid.
Yeah. Yeah, but also at this point, boxing is commissions. Like you said, it's also that boxing has a lot more funding at this point. It's been around for a lot longer. It's been, you know, a much bigger sport in some cases for a very long time. Things like that. Yeah, I don't know. It's something that definitely the MMA community changes needs to start looking at working on. But but dude, we got some exciting stuff up ahead. You know, we got lightweight division to sort out with Gaethje and interim titles and Khabib. We've got the bantamweight series, which is dudes just fighting for the belt at the moment. You got Amanda Nunes, who's waiting for the next challenger. We're at a very good time in MMA, dude. We're at one of the most beautiful moments in MMA history right now, where we've got some incredible champs that are really putting on some shows for us. Like, we've had some pretty incredible cards recently.
Holloway, Volkanovski coming up again.
Yeah, exactly. Fuck Yoel Romero and Israel Adesanya, but that's another conversation.
No, but Adesanya Costa, that's a banger. Banging fight, yeah.
Cool. So we've kind of hit the like 1 hour, 30 minute mark. So we're going to start rounding this off now. Last couple things that we wanted to talk about was just we wanted to discuss, you know, often the UFC does things like Fight of the Night and stuff like that. So we wanted to give our opinions on Fight of the Night, who had the most style, what was the best knockout, that kind of stuff. So the categories that we talked about, Tom, so what was your knockout of the night?
So the two clear candidates for me were Sean O'Malley's knockout and Cody Garbrandt's knockout. I'm going to go with Garbrandt for two reasons. One, I thought the setup was better, and I thought the result was slightly better as well. So, Garbrandt just nicks Sean O'Malley in my mind.
For me, that's fair enough. Yeah. I'm actually going to go with Sean O'Malley. Now, this is interesting. For sheer animal, like, the sheer animal in me is like, yes, Garbrandt, you destroyed him. That punch was so powerful. Like, wow. I'm like, that's amazing. But I love the, like, style of Sean O'Malley. I love how, and again, to me, that punch felt effortless. Like, I watched that punch, and it reminds me of the Jose Aldo punch that Conor McGregor threw. It reminds me of the Eddie Alvarez punch that Conor McGregor threw. Like, it looked like it should not have knocked anyone out, but it just drops a dude, like, and a veteran at that, Eddie Wineland, I'm pretty sure had never been dropped in his career. And he just got knocked the hell out. So for me, that little boom was pretty damn beautiful. And the fact that he was just like, woo, and walked away. cool. Second one, fight of the night. Overall fight of the night, regardless of the end result.
Fight of the night. That is tough. Because I didn't feel like there was any fights that were like hugely in the balance going into the last round. As far as just like, so I'm going to go fight of the night entertainment value. And this will probably be surprising, but I'm going to go just Nunes, because I was so impressed by just her skills, man. I love just watching her as a martial artist. It's just like watching, you know, someone that is a master at anything, like a musical instrument, or, you know, with a paintbrush, or driving a car, or whatever. She's a master, man, and it was just awesome just to watch her do her thing.
Yeah, I 100% echo that. I was about to say Amanda Nunes as well, and I was about to echo the fact that, yeah, I was going to put it in a much douchier way. I was going to say it was like watching art. It was like watching poetry in motion. Like, you, it's literally like that. The only way I can describe, so people who don't understand combat sports will never, like, or people who don't watch them because they think it's too violent and things like that, and don't take the time to learn about the, and again, boxing fans, fucking forget people who don't even watch fighting, boxing fans in of themselves who don't understand the intricacies of like grappling and clench work on the cage and stuff like that, and are like, oh, it's so boring, like, I want to see two dudes, like, the sweet science, man, boxing. It's like, dude, the sweet science, but she's doing the sweet science in five different areas at once. And they're fighting with gloves that are half the weight. Like, what, like, I just go, dude, that is the truest form of martial art. Like, watching Amanda Nunes do what she did was like you said, watching Michael Jordan shoot the winning three. It was like watching Usain Bolt run the 100 meters. It was like any of those big, it was like watching Martin Luther King give the, you know, MLK speech. It's one of those legends, And it's like Bill Gates invading Microsoft. Like, shit, it's when you're at the top of the thing and you are showing your artwork, you're showing your ability, it's beautiful. I don't care what it's in. I don't care if that is beating the crap out of someone. It's still beautiful. Like, that is, I 100% agree with you. It was truly, truly beautiful to watch her fight and to continue to see her do what she does and it not be a fluke. It not be a, oh, I won the belt and now I lose it the next fight. It be, I'm here to stay, and I'm consistent as fuck as well. Like, yes. Doesn't change. This, like, nothing changes. Cool. So the next one was, we said most style. Who do you think had the most style? Who was your style guy?
So I'm thinking two things. One thing is like tats. So Cody Garbrandt is committed to his tat game, man. He's got so much ink now on him. So he had a back piece that was crazy. And he's got a good quality tattoo artist. You know, he's not just throwing, like, he's not just getting ink just to get ink. He's got someone that he's paying to do some good stuff. So that's one element of style. I think Nunez has a full arm sleeve now as well. So that's pretty nice. But as far as like actual, like, yeah, a little bit like it factor style, I'm going to go Sean O'Malley, man. There's something about Sean O'Malley that, like, he hasn't even arrived. He's not even a top 15, and we're talking about Sean O'Malley. Like, there's something about the kid.
That's true. I was going to say Aljamain Sterling. I was going to go more for fighting style, but also his out-of-ring style. He's wearing the, like, massive gold chain. He's got the headband. He's coming out, like, dancing a little bit. But for me, it was his style, dude. The way he moves, like, again, don't get me wrong, like, I find watching Dominic Cruz and people like that hella uncomfortable, just like everyone else. Like, you're just like, there's something really uncomfortable by the way you move. Like, no one understands it. But I'll tell you what, it's entertaining as fuck, dude. When a dude's like doing like all the their hands are by their waist and you're like, the fuck is happening? I'm sure the dude in the cage is also going, what the fuck are you doing? Yeah. You know?
So, are we fighting or are we breakdancing right now?
So for me, I'm like, I love Aljamain Sterling's, his way of that he moves. And not only that, dude, for me, I love jiu-jitsu. I really, really love the intricacies of jiu-jitsu. And for him to pull the back mount, like,
standing
was dope. Like, anytime any sort of jiu-jitsu is pulled when someone is standing, whether it be, you know,
Brian Ortega
getting like a guillotine, like jumping guard guillotine, or you have Demetrius Johnson suplex arm barring you into the ground, you know, and things like that. Like, whenever it's a stat, or John Jones standing guillotining Lyoto Machida up against the fence, like, dude,
even like Ronda Rousey, like, scramble into an arm bar. Like, how did that just happen? What just happened there? And she's in an full arm bar. Like, that's beautiful.
Yeah. It's, yeah, so I don't know. I love that. I thought that was cool. And the final category that you and me thought would be fun is best walkout music. Now, you and me can only remember one walkout from this event. It'll be something that we'll look into next time. We promise everyone that we'll make more notes of the music and that we like as they come out. But we thought the best walkout music was Felicia Spencer with Flash by Queen. We thought that was quite funny. We were like, I'm not sure if this really gets you in the mood, but nice. Like, yeah. It's a good choice.
The thing that was funny about it was we were like trying to embody what it would feel like to walk out with that song. And it's almost like, I'm ready to party. I'm ready to drink. I'm ready to have some fun. Might do some dancing. And so we didn't understand it in that level. But then we watched her and we were like, I think that's what she's feeling right now as well. And I'm not happy about it. Like, I don't know if this is good for her.
She's dancing, we're like, and she's like, she's half singing the lyrics, we're like, uh-oh.
Like, dude, spit a lyric. Flash.
Ah. Universe. It's like, but the funny thing is, I just love that it's, to me, when I, like, if you were to ask me, picture a fighter, like, warming up to that song, I see someone doing, like, fire feet, and being like, bah, bah, ah, and like, it's like, very, like, almost like, I don't even know. Like, I don't imagine it being very angry or ready to fucking punch someone in the face. I imagine it to be more of like you said, let's go out to a club. Let's, I'm getting down. Flash. And you're like, yeah, definitely a bit more of that than I want to go punch someone in the face right now, you know?
But the other side of it is she brought it, man. Let's raise a hand to Felicia Spencer. She something awesome. To be
for Queen. Who knows, dude? Maybe that's the secret.
Maybe that's the way to go.
Right. This has been a great one. Thank you, everyone, for watching. Hope you enjoyed the very first Fight Night recap. We will be doing this pretty much on every big UFC card that we watch, as well as also any boxing stuff that we also watch. yeah, that's anything else you want to say, Tom, before we dip out?
No, that was it, man. That was fun. And yeah, we're psyched. We're picking up some momentum. We're getting a little bit better with although my tech was a bit sloppy to start with, we're getting a little bit better with just understanding the platform. So looking forward to some more of this. Thanks guys for supporting. And yeah, hopefully see you soon.
Also, just a quick thing, guys, keep your eyes out. We will have a Homie and the Dude Instagram page, Facebook page, sorted very, very soon. We're just getting our artwork done by our amazing artist, Jamie Drummond. Shout out to him. He's absolutely smashing it. Anyone who needs graphic design work, give Jamie a shout. But other than that, we are really excited to keep bringing you guys this content, Fast and Furious style. Vin Diesel grabbing the top of a Corona like a fucking man style. So the way he holds the bowl, he holds like the neck and is like, an idiot, dude.
On that note,
Ryan was like, it's so that he doesn't cover the branding so that they can do product placement.
Exactly.
Like, oh, so genius. I was like, I didn't even think about that. I was like, I thought it was part of his character. Like, he's just one of those beefy dudes who's like, yeah, I'm a grip on beer from the top. Right. Much love. And thanks for watching, guys.
Love you guys. Take care.
Right. Going off live.